Welcome to The Sound of Economics, a podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and in this episode of The Sound of Economics, we will discuss the financial fragility of European households in the time of COVID-19. I have the pleasure to have with me today Maria De Mertzis and Anna Maria Lusardi, who have both authored a paper published by Bruegel with a novel research on the topic. Hi Maria and Anna Maria, how are you?
Hi Giuseppe, thanks for having us.
Hi Anna Maria.
Hi, thanks.
You're joining from far away, Anna Maria, right?
Yes, I'm joining you from Washington. Good morning.
Good. Very well. So, in the wake of COVID-19, you asked how well prepared households were in the European Union, including the United Kingdom, to handle an unexpected expense. And before the pandemic hit, a substantial share of EU households reported that they would be unable to handle unexpected expenses. In some EU countries, many households had savings equivalent to just a few weeks of basic consumptions. So, to start our conversation, we want to go a little bit in-depth in this research. But first of all, to give us a little bit of a flavor, what did you find out concerning the way households' finances in these countries have been impacted by the pandemic so far? And maybe the similarities or differences?
Yeah. So, yeah, thanks, Giuseppe. I mean, we're going to have the chance to go a little bit more on the details of all of this. So let me just give you the global gist. The results are, in some ways, rather striking. We found that 1 in 3 households in the EU are unable to meet what I would call a medium-sized shock, not a very big shock, but also not a daily type of expense, or things like an unexpected surgery or a funeral cost, or you know, something breaks down in the house and you have to fix it. 1 in 3 in the EU households. I mean, I was personally rather shocked about this. But before I go into the details and explain a little bit more about some of the differences, some of the similarities, let me go a step back and explain why we're looking at this. And for this, I'm really delighted that I had the opportunity to work with Anna Maria on this and Martha, who is a research assistant at us at Bruegel. Because this is a line of research that is a very important in sort of a more generic sense, in a terms that of identifying the household as an important contributor to financial stability. You see, as soon as we all entered the shutdown in Brussels, where we are, Giuseppe, the shutdown happened mid-March. One of the things that we saw in the numbers was immediately people being laid off. You could see it in the news. You could see it everywhere. So, you know, it immediately occurred to us that, oh, what will happen to the household? Can the household make ends meet? A number of people were laid off. And yet, do they have enough savings to live on? Or is that going to fall really on the heads of the government to try and support this? So this is very much the motivation for addressing this issue. And I turned to Anna, who really is an authority on this and who has really started this this line of research back in 2009, I think. And she will tell us about this a little bit more in a minute. Looking originally at the US data, and I asked her, you know, would you be able to help us think about the strength of the household, so we can identify how well prepared households are to deal with quite such a big shock as the pandemic shock.
And Anna Maria, as Maria said, you've been researching the concept of financial fragility since a while, since probably the financial crisis, after the financial crisis of 2007-2008, I suppose. And from your point of view, maybe you can contextualize and explain us a little bit better, both on the methodological side, but also, you know, the concept itself of financial fragility as you have been observing it since a decade.
Indeed, thank you, Giuseppe. We started this project back in 2009, observing the US economy that was coming out of a very major crisis. And our attention turned to the families, to the households who were affected so much by the crisis. And we look at a different question that had been asked in the past, which is not just whether people are saving for retirement for the long term. For example, as many often we have studied, but whether families have the capacity to face a shock? In other words, do they have the reserves in the short term if something happened suddenly? And we studied this after the financial crisis because, of course, it was such a major event that really depleted the resources of families. And we designed at that time this term of financial fragility, which we measure as the capacity of people to face an unexpected shock using their own resources and in a relatively long period of time. We had a month at that time. So when we look at that data, so that capacity to face a shock in the US in 2009, we saw that as many as 50% of families would not have been able to face a shock. And that's why we focus on the fragility of families. And that fragility, first of all, is an indicator of the pain that household might face and might feel in a situation of uncertainty, and also the capacity of the economy to go through a period of, for example, or problems or sudden shocks.
So, if I may, like a follow up questions. So for our listeners to understand exactly, when you would define a situation in the household as connected with a financial fragility, what would be the entity of the shock that you were putting as an indicator, as a measurement?
Mm-hmm. So in our first analysis, we look at the mid-size shock. So we had asked whether people could come up with $2,000 in 30 days. Why $2,000? We were thinking of a mid-size shock, something like, you know, a sudden repair, a sudden medical expense, and so on. It wasn't just a day-to-day in a small expense, but it's also not a major shock. And we had given the capacity to come up with these resources in 30 days, and also know that we used the term resources. We didn't mean necessarily that people had, for example, savings. You could face the shock in a variety of ways, for example, relying on family and friends, working more, selling something, and so on. And we did see, in fact, that, you know, many households didn't have the savings to come up with shocks, but had thought of a variety of other ways to come up with those resources. And that's why I think this financial fragility is a complex measure. It doesn't necessarily mean do people have the savings or they have the liquidity, but do they have the capacity to face a shock? And this is why, you know, this capacity is so much linked, not just in a sense to what people have, but the capacity to manage those resources. And this is also why in our research, first of all, we also link financial fragility to financial literacy. And that's why often when we talk about financial fragility, we so much talk also about financial literacy as one of the determinants of household to manage their resources. And by the way, their resources not just for the long term to, for example, face a declining income when they retire, but in the short term to face a shock that can, you know, always happen to us.
Maria, this concept of financial literacy is very much connected, as Anna Maria said. How would you explain the connections, but as well, how would you explain the concept itself?
Yeah, if you allow me, Giuseppe, can I come back to that? So when we talk about, I'm sure at the end, and our listeners will be very interested to hear, well, how can we ensure that financial fragility reduces? And then I think financial literacy is going to be a very important component of that answer. But if I may go back a little bit back to your question, Giuseppe, and you've heard Anna say that in the US, the question effectively boils down to, do you have $2,000 to spare if you needed to? In Europe, the amount is different, and it varies from country to country because the purchasing power per country is very different. But effectively, what the data that we use says is that, can you find that amount below which you would be at the risk of poverty. And for example, in the UK, this amount is £850. If you can't find £850 within a month, or if you don't have £850 within a month, you are really below the risk of poverty. In Spain, this is €700. And that varies from country to country because incomes and purchasing power are different. So that more or less is the amounts that will define financial fragility in European households. And in the paper, we explain the exact, the precise amount that the data uses to define that.
And therefore, coming back to the findings of the paper, I mean, if you have to describe the photography that you picture over there, what kind of differences you have discovered, and especially connected with the pandemic crisis at the moment?
I want to start by mentioning one of our results, and Maria can talk about the two measures that we have. I want to mention the first one, when we basically look at data, which is the European Union statistics on income and living conditions, and they ask whether a household can afford an unexpected required expense and pay through their own resources. So, using the last data we have, so well before the pandemic, what we do see basically is that on average, one in three households in Europe could not face this unexpected expense. So in other words, well before the crisis, people wouldn't be able to face a small shock, let alone a big one. And this is why we are talking about the financial fragility of many families, basically well before the crisis. And not just that we see this, many European countries, you know, as I said, on average, but there are also several countries, the one, for example, who were affected quite severely by the previous financial crisis, or the more recent European Union countries. So, for example, here we are talking about Latvia, Croatia, Romania, and of course, Greece and Cyprus. There, the financial fragility is much higher. One in two households wouldn't be able to face an unexpected shock. What we also do, we look across some of those countries, you know, and try to identify the groups which are even more fragile. And this group are, for example, family with children. And also they are single parents. And disproportionately, they are the single women with children, which are a lot more fragile. And across countries, when we look at this group, we find that one in two, and in fact, even more than one in two single women with children wouldn't be able to face an unexpected shock. So in other words, such a big part of household are unable to face a shock, and we are, again, before the pandemic, and some group are even more fragile. And this, of course, is important, and it can have important consequences for policy.
Maria, would you like to add something on this?
Yes, of course. And you know, what Anna just described is the first part, where the survey asks people to evaluate themselves, whether they are financially fragile. Can you meet this cost if you had to? What is your answer? Yes or no? So this is, if you like, it's the way that individuals, you and I, we perceive our ability to meet that cost. You know, and the results, as you heard from Anna, they're not very encouraging. You know, there are particularly vulnerable groups in the EU that self-assess that they're quite financially fragile. So then we ask the question, well, what if we try and look at more objective measures? Why don't we just look at the money that people have in the bank accounts, and SIBO, maybe, you know, they do have savings, and here we're talking about really liquid savings, things that you can reach immediately. We're not talking about wealth, which is of course would characterize the richness of household. The types of shocks we're thinking about, you know, unexpected expenses require liquidity, you know, being able to draw on resources very quickly. So, you know, money in the bank would qualify, and again, we find that there are, first of all the households, or the vast majority of households in the EU have got bank accounts. So Europe is basically banked, which is a good thing. But again, the amount of savings that people can draw, and let's say on the checking account or in savings account, is very vastly different whether you're talking about Latvia or you're talking about Malta and Sweden. You know, you have savings to the order of magnitude of 6 or 7 months in the richer countries and just a few weeks in the poorer countries. And, you know, if you wanted to compare this to a bundle of goods which are necessary, let's say your rent or, you know, buying the basics, you can make your savings last a little bit more. But again, you know, in rich countries, you can go up to sort of 20 months. But in the poorer countries, you can only go up to 3, maybe 4 weeks worth of savings to deal with an unexpected shock. And so, you know, there are both very disappointing results, at least in my opinion, but also vast differences in the way that both households self-assess their ability to meet unexpected expenses. But also when we're looking at more objective criteria, things like money in the bank accounts. So really, I think the one message we draw here, and you know, Anna, you can really tell me what you think on this, is that you know, we don't look at the poorest segments of the population here. We're looking at the middle class. We're looking at averages, at medians. You know, so we're looking at the median. I mean, we're not talking at the most vulnerable ones. The most vulnerable ones will be a lot more vulnerable than what we just described. But and yet again, the median, the middle class, is not as financially secure as we might want it to be. I think that is really the message that we draw from this paper, and you know, to remind us that you know, the middle class in Europe, you know, might not be able to pay for an unexpected funeral cost. I'm sure we can do better than this.
And to continue on that, one of the other graph that we show in the paper, which I think is important, is that when you look at over time, you know, the proportion of families which are and remain financially fragile is still high. So even when there are good economic conditions, even when many economies are, you know, doing well and they are in a period of economic growth, that growth doesn't lift all boats. And this is why this financial fragility is a structural problem that, you know, it's not a problem of a contingent problem of this particular shock. We really have to think of ways in which we can make all of the families a lot more resilient, not just to big shock, but even to the big one, even to the small one that all of us could face.
Well, obviously, you point out to a crucial problem. It to me, to my mind, it comes to as well the huge and bigger issue of the crisis of the middle class, which we have been witnessing in the past decades in former mature industrial societies, and that is a trend the US and in Europe and so on. So it's an indicator also of this wider thing, but I will not want to get into that discussion because we will need like 3 podcasts and not one on this. But coming back to the issue of the paper itself and what you point out, what are the kind of policy recommendations that you would give, provided exactly this baseline that you've been observing and measuring in the research that you've been doing, especially considering the context in which we are now of the pandemics?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, a big question, and there isn't really one answer. And as we pointed out, given the vast differences between countries, you cannot really have one policy that's going to work for everybody. There are really quite clearly a greater need for targeted policies across different countries. So I think that's the first lesson to draw. And by simply looking at the graphs in our paper, you will see the vast differences immediately. But I think an important point to point out here, and you know, we heard Anna saying this is a structural problem. It's not about just provide money and problem solved. It's not really about just income. Yes, more income is always a good idea to help vulnerable groups, to help the middle class. But here we're talking about savings behavior, about preparedness. Understanding is not just about, you know, saving for pensions, as Anna said. It's also saving for, you know, unexpected shocks that you might have to deal with at very unexpected times. So, and here is not about income. Here is about changing behavior. It's about structural policies that are going to help the individual understand and plan for the future, the long-term future and the immediate the future a lot more effectively. And this is when, and come back to your question, the original question that you asked me, Giuseppe, the issue of financial literacy. There are many initiatives. And actually, here I also take the opportunity to tell our audience that Anna Maria is also the chair of financial literacy group in Italy. And she will have firsthand experience on exactly which measures are used and to what effect. And you know, changing saving behavior and helping the households prepare better, stand on its own feet better, requires financial education, requires training, requires advice at right points in time. And this is certainly one recommendation. In the paper, we go a little bit beyond that. And, you know, coming back to the motivation for this, the household is an integral part of the financial system. And when you're worried about the financial system, you don't only worry about banks, you don't only worry about financial institutions, you worry also about the households in exactly the way that we show in the paper. So we recommend that we monitor the financial health, the financial wellness of the household as an important contributor to financial stability, or in its absence, to financial instability. And, you know, we have ways of monitoring the financial stability, the financial wellness of different players in the system. And we recommend that we do that also for the household. In the context of the EU semester, for example, which is a very big monitoring process at the EU, we could really include some of those indicators that we use in the paper and monitor them in real time in economic terms, to try and catch up early indications of weaknesses that may prove problematic in the future.
I just want to mention some of the things we are doing in Italy. The Financial Education Committee is very concerned and hard at work in improving the financial literacy in Italy. We have a plan that is guided by a national strategy for financial literacy. And some of the initiatives that are related to, for example, this research paper is that we have launched big initiatives, for example, Financial Education Month, which is the month of October, which really is to try to raise awareness of this important topic and to have a lot of financial education initiatives throughout the country. But also recently, because of the financial crisis, on our portal of financial education, which is called Quello che Conta, and can be found at www.quelloqueconta.gov.it, we have also have a new website about 10 suggestions about how to deal with personal finance during a time of crisis. So what are some of the things that people can do to deal with these specific crises? Just as to mention again how important it is to also give guidance, to also think about the households and the type of financial decision they have to make. And third, we have taken a lot of initiative, try to have financial education in school so we can educate the young, but also in the workplace. So that not only we, when we look at workers, think of their saving for retirement, but also the saving for the short term. So we are all doing this so that, you know, households become more financially resilient. And this is, I think, an important topic for policy as well.
Anna Maria, when you speak about doing this at school, are there also proposals to include financial literacy in the actual curricula of the, or is this just side activities, side projects, but not something that will become, you know, part of the core education?
We hope that it will become part of the core education, and I think it is, in a sense, today an essential skill that every young person need to navigate the current society and to participate to society. At the moment, what we have done, we have designed some guidelines to do financial education in school. So there are precise, in a sense, concepts and a list of the topics that a teacher should teach when they teach financial education in school. And that's important. You know, we need also standards for financial literacy in school. And also we need to train the teachers. And certainly we need to find a way to put it in the curriculum so it becomes part of what every student does and learns in Italy. And I would say starting from the elementary school up to the university. And we should continue this learning throughout our lifetime.
Good. We are coming almost towards the end of this episode. I would like to ask Maria if you have some other reflections or thoughts on the wider topic that we are presenting today.
As you can see, both Anna and I are quite excited about this issue. It's an important issue for promoting welfare of households and welfare of the society at the very end. Education in different forms, and financial literacy is part of education, but it's more than that. It's a crucial skill, as Anna said, for the future. And I think it's important that we try and promote this. But also just to emphasize that it isn't just about education. It's also about macro financial stability here. We monitor the financial health of the system, but we forget that actually the household, the individual, is an integral component of that. Healthy individuals will make the system more robust. And these types of exercises that we're talking about in this paper and hopefully in future research is very much about ensuring the financial health of the individual as well. So we are very excited that Anna has agreed to collaborate with us on this, and I hope that we will continue our collaboration in the future.
And Anna Maria, some last words from your side.
First of all, I want to echo Maria's words that we are very excited about this collaboration with Bruegel and the capacity to not only do research, but be able to be a voice for the households, remind everybody, policymaker, practitioner, that the well-being of household is really important. And one way in which we can impact the well-being of household is make sure that they are financially resilient, not just in the long term, but also in the short term. And just to repeat what Maria said, financially resilient households create a better and more robust economic system. We need to look at the ecosystem to be able to design better policy. The households are an important part, and it's really important that we pay attention to the household, that we make sure that we are providing the tools for this household to be able to live a stable life.
Well, thank you. I think that this is a very important message for our listeners, and a very important message as well for the continuation of such important research and policy recommendations towards the decision makers. And as you both mentioned, we are continuing to look into this issue at Bruegel. So this is not neither the first neither the last research and study that we will do on the topic, so something that we should continue to follow up. And of course, you can find the paper by Anna Maria and Maria on the website www.bruegel.org, and as usual, you can find also all the other analysis of our scholars, both on the coronavirus crisis, but as well about many other economic issues. So I would like to thank Anna Maria and Maria for joining us today for The Sound of Economics. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.